I remember my first taste of power. I had been elected class president of the third grade at Coleytown Elementary School in Westport, Connecticut. This was a huge opportunity for my grade school career. Now, to be perfectly honest, this was shared power. I was co-president with Suzanne Baker. But, if you must know, that was okay with me because I had a little bit of a crush on Suzanne Baker. So sharing the presidency with her was kind of all right by me. I started out that year with so many ideas and hopes for what I could accomplish as third grade class president. The world was before me. But I learned a lot about power that year. I learned that it sometimes isn't all that you think it could be, that power has its limitations, and that power can disappoint. If you're new to PBC or you haven't been around in a while, you should know that we are right in the middle of a 10-month series on the life of David. We've called it A Life of Passion. And we're tracking this individual whose story is the longest narrative in the Bible, except for the life of Jesus. We've divided his life up into chapters to kind of get a grasp on the flow of his life. And the story of each chapter is in some ways a story of power. He starts off powerless as the forgotten eighth son who tends sheep as a shepherd. But God calls this young man to a new role. He gives him a responsibility, but at first, he ends up running as a fugitive from someone who has far more power than him, and in fact, who's trying to kill him. Eventually, though, that individual dies, and David is installed as the king. He spends some time building his power until finally he reigns as king over all Israel. That's the chapter that we've most recently been in. But today we turn a page to a new chapter. Having arrived as king, the story starts to focus on David as father, family dynamics, mistakes, and consequences. Unfortunately, this chapter begins with a very dark story. We've seen that David is a complicated character. He's a mixture of honor and failure, loyalty and rebellion, sacrifice and manipulation, humility and pride. Progressive scholars want to portray him as a villain. They question every action. Sometimes conservative scholars want to call him a hero in blind naivete. The truth lies somewhere in the middle. He's like us. He's villain and hero wrapped into one. But this morning, we see only the dark side of David. This is David at his unimaginable worst. We will watch as David compels a young woman to have sex with him and then orchestrates the murder of her husband. Today, we will see David in agonizing detail abusing power. Frank Underwood, the rising politician in the Netflix TV show House of Cards, reports that a great man once said, "Everything is about sex, except sex. Sex is about power." That's been true in several places throughout David's story already. We've seen how sex and power can intertwine in dangerous ways. But nowhere is that more true than the story of David and Bathsheba that's found in 2 Samuel chapter 11, the story we'll be looking at this morning. This is a powerful man abusing his position to satisfy his lust. The power of the throne is new to David, remember. I think he's somewhat surprised by it, but I think he likes it. I think he stumbles into the dark side of power and finds out about the limitations of his own power. And along the way, he violates one life and ends another. It's an incredibly helpful story for us. We live in a world of power. People and organizations and corporations and systems and governments that are trying to amass and protect and establish their own authority. We can easily feel like we exist underneath, at the behest of forces that are way more powerful than us. Some of you have been victims of people or systems that have used their power to hurt you. sometimes in minor ways and sometimes in life-changing, devastating ways. Our story this morning will speak to those of us who have been victims of abusive power. But I'm not sure that most of us realize just how much we have in common with David, the perpetrator of these crimes. We're often aware of how much power the people around us have, but we sometimes underestimate the power and influence that we ourselves wield. One of the things I've become especially convinced of lately is that when people don't know the power they have, they can be particularly dangerous in asserting that power. You may not realize it, but this is a room full of powerful people. And I don't mean the person sitting next to you. I mean you. Just by the fact of where you are in the world, you have power. You have power because of the jobs, the professions, the volunteer opportunities, the organizations you're associated with. You have power because of the money available to you. You have power because of your education. You have power because of the relationships you have with all sorts of people. But even if none of that were true, you have power simply because God created you in his image and gave you authority over his creation. You have tremendous influence in the world. What do we need to learn about wielding that power well? How can we protect ourselves from abusing it? How can we avoid hurting the people around us? And maybe most importantly, what do we have to learn about worshiping a God who himself is all powerful? This morning's story will offer something for all of us, victims, kings, and worshipers. So let's watch David and see what we can learn from the darkest moment of his life. As most stories do, this story begins in verse 1. And I want you to notice as you read this story the word sent. It's a very important word because sending is an act of power. The one who sends exerts his or her power by sending another. So as we read throughout the story, notice that word. Here's verse 1. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. And they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. David sent and David remained. This was the time when kings were supposed to go out to battle, but David didn't. He sent someone else. Notice that the story doesn't begin with David abusing his power. Initially, it's not that he uses his power for a bad purpose. It's that he fails to use his power for the good purpose that he ought to have used it for. As king, he was supposed to fight for the sake of his people. But he sends someone else, and he stays behind. Very few terrible mistakes happen out of the blue. Usually they start with what seems like a smaller decision. And they grow, and they develop, until each successive decision seems easier than the last. And often doing the wrong thing starts off by not doing the right thing. Early in my Christian life, I felt like I was very focused on avoiding sin, not doing the things that I shouldn't be doing. But lately, I feel like I've spent a lot more time asking the question, what ought I to be doing? What is God calling me to do? And when I answer that question, and when I live in that place, there's a whole lot less time and energy and opportunity to do the things I ought not. If David had used his power correctly, if he'd gone out to war, we wouldn't even have a story this morning. There'd be nothing to tell. But of course, that's not what happens. He abdicates his responsibility, and that leaves David powerful and bored. Here's verse 2. It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house, that he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. Like many well-known stories, people often remember this story differently than the way it's told in the text, because we build up ideas from hearing it so many times. The picture many people have in their minds is of Bathsheba, sensuously bathing on her roof. Perhaps she even knew that David was watching. Perhaps she was trying to draw his attention. You see this perspective often in artistic depictions of the story, like this painting from 1899 that we've sanitized for our use. But the text doesn't say that Bathsheba was on her roof. It only says that David was on his roof. David's palace was built high on a hill above the whole village of Jerusalem. Most of the homes in Jerusalem would have open courtyards in the middle with cisterns in them to collect rainwater. That was their source of water. Only David, from the roof of his palace, had the vantage point to see into not only Bathsheba's, but all of the homes in Jerusalem. A few verses later, we also find out why Bathsheba was bathing. It was the ritual cleansing that was supposed to be performed in the evening, 7 days after the completion of her menstrual period. This is a law given in Leviticus 15. It may not have even been a complete bath. It's likely that she wasn't fully naked. The bath wasn't for the purpose of cleaning herself. It was a ritual prescribed to indicate that enough time had passed that she was now officially considered clean. So it's possible that this painting from 1599 is a more accurate depiction of what might have actually happened. Bathsheba might have been fully clothed in her courtyard with servants attending her. The point here is that Bathsheba wasn't doing anything wrong. On the contrary, she was following the law. She was performing a ritual cleansing in her courtyard where the water was. She wasn't looking for an extramarital affair. She wasn't being seductive. Bathsheba wasn't seducing David. It was David who, similar to Nebuchadnezzar, at the height of his power and pride, walked along his roof, looking out at the kingdom that he commanded. It was David who, at the height of his power and pride and boredom, walked around on his roof and noticed Bathsheba. He sees her, and he sends to find out about her. Verse 3, and David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? David's servant makes a point of not only identifying her, but identifying her husband and her father. Eliam and Uriah are both listed as members of David's mighty men. This was an elite group of soldiers who'd been with David for years, probably ever since he was running from Saul in the wilderness. Eliam's father, Ahithophel, Bathsheba's grandfather, was listed as one of David's court counselors for years prior. He'd been in the court advising David. I think this servant knew what David was contemplating. I think he could tell that David was starting to see Bathsheba as an object. And he wanted to remind David that this is the granddaughter, the daughter, and the wife of men who are important to you. This is a person that you're talking about. And at this point, David should have snapped out of his trance. He should have realized and said, oh, what was I thinking? But he didn't. Verse 4 records what happens next. So David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had been purifying herself from her uncleanness. Then she returned to her house. It was a slow buildup, but then in a flash, it happened. Listen to the progression of what David does in these four verses. David sent, remained, arose, walked, saw, sent, inquired, sent, took, lay. David sent, he took her, and he lay with her. A few chapters earlier, similar language is used when David sends for Mephibosheth, a forgotten cripple, and takes Mephibosheth into his palace. But in that case, the purpose is to bless him, to pour riches upon him that he couldn't even imagine. In this case, the sending and taking is for purely selfish reasons. It began with him staying home from war. He failed to use his power responsibly. That left a void. People are dangerous when they're bored. It's true for kids and kings alike. David's power wasn't being put to good use, so he used it for poor use. Now, when people describe David's sin, when they talk about this story, they usually use the word adultery. But the more I've studied this passage, the more uncomfortable I've been with that way of describing these events. Adultery can certainly take many forms, but in my mind, it implies a consensual relationship between two people. So when people talk about this as adultery, it's almost as if they're saying that David and Bathsheba fell in love and had a romantic affair. But that doesn't appear to be the case at all. David had all the power. Bathsheba had none. He was probably 50 years old. She was probably 20. He was the king. She was the wife of his soldier. Only David is ever condemned for this sexual encounter. Bathsheba was apparently innocent of any wrongdoing. Even after his death, she is referred to as the wife of Uriah because she wasn't unfaithful to him. She was sent for and taken. Nathan uses the same word for taken in the next chapter when he constructs this parable about a powerful rich man who takes a lamb from a poor man for his own purposes. And then later, after Uriah's death, when David takes Bathsheba as his wife, the word used there is an agricultural word, and it would be literally translated that David harvested Bathsheba. David's sin, to me, sounds a lot more like rape than adultery. One scholar has labeled it power rape to highlight the power dynamic at play. And the question is whether Bathsheba consented to this sexual encounter. I'm convinced that the question is barely worth asking. In those days, if the king sent for you, you went. There was no choice to be made. Even asking about a choice would be a ridiculous question in the context. Bathsheba wasn't looking for this. She didn't want this. She was compelled by the king. Now, it's hard to know exactly what word to use to describe these events. Even today, we have active, vibrant, sometimes hostile debates about what constitutes sexual abuse, what constitutes sexual assault, what constitutes rape. We're not sure even how to talk about these things. It's hard enough to label behaviors in our culture that we're familiar with. So to look back at a culture 3,000 years ago and to label the event is notoriously difficult. We're going to spend some more time in a few weeks talking specifically about sexual abuse when we get to the story of Tamar, who was explicitly and violently raped by her half-brother. For now, we're going to consider the overarching theme of power. But I want to point out that when we call this sin adultery, I think we make two mistakes. First, we let David off too easy. Bathsheba wasn't involved in this. This was his choice, his sin. This was his doing. And second, I think we underestimate the degree to which power was involved in this situation. This story is just as much about power as it is about sex. It's about David abusing his power to satisfy his lust. David took what he wanted. But what he wanted was a person, a young woman that he knew, whose husband was fighting his battle, whose grandfather advised him. David sent for her and took her. That's why it's so important for us to understand the power that we have. Do you realize how much influence you have over the people and circumstances in your life? Do you think about how you're wielding that power? How do you use your power? Parents have power. Bosses have power. Leaders have power. Teachers have power. But they aren't the only ones. Children have power. Students have power. Employees have power. Spouses and boyfriends and girlfriends and friends and colleagues all have power. If I asked you to name the powerful people in your life, I'd be willing to bet that you would start by looking up. And you would tell me about all the people who exert power over you. But you might not think about the fact that all the people you have influence over. We're hyper aware of those people in our lives who have more or different power to influence us. But here's the interesting thing about power. Everybody has a boss, but everybody is a boss to someone else. Someone has more power than you, but no one has all the power. Someone else has less power than you. Everyone has some kind of influence over someone else. Why do we spend so much time thinking and worrying about the people that have power over us? What if we spent that time thinking about how we use the power we have? Exploring creative ways to use our influence to help those people who might be vulnerable or hurting in our culture. Don't worry so much about the power you don't have. Worry about the power you do have. How are you using your power? Well, up until now, David has had all the power. He has all the action. He's been doing all the sending. But then David learns that even the king of Israel doesn't have as much power as he thinks. Listen to verse 5. And the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, "I'm pregnant." This is the turning point of the story. First, David did all the sending, but now Bathsheba sends to David. Initially, no one could stop David. He had whatever he wanted. He could do anything. But now Bathsheba sends to him and lets him know that his actions have consequences. Consequences that are outside of his control. The power dynamic has been turned upside down. Now, Bathsheba seems like the powerless one in this story. She is the victim, but here she exercises her agency. She acts. She does something. She sends. And she discovers something incredibly important, that even victims are not without power. Victims in particular have this unique ability, this unique influence. What they can do is to make known the consequences of others' actions. For victims of abuse or violence, this is often called breaking silence. It's the process of learning to say what has happened to you. And it might seem like a simple thing, like a small deal, but in reality, this is the great power that belongs to every victim of injustice. They can make evil known. They can expose. They can bring truth to light. And if anyone should know about the power that truth has, it's Christians. We know that the truth has great power. And so Bathsheba exposes the evil of David's actions. And there are a lot of reasons why she might not have chosen to do this. Often, when victims of abuse come forward, they aren't believed. They're questioned. Sometimes, even worse, they're blamed. How many times is it asked of a woman who has been sexually assaulted, what was she wearing? As if clothing choice, any clothing choice, could justify sexual violence. This is a very real issue, even in our backyard. An article was published recently in the Huffington Post about the problem of sexual assault at Stanford. The title was, "Stanford Has a Trust Problem When It Comes to Sexual Assault." The author, among other things, reports that only 2.7% of victims in the university felt comfortable reporting sexual assault. The low rates are attributed to people not believing that if they do come forward, the process will go well at all. So what Bathsheba does here is incredibly brave. Don't underestimate her courage in sending to David. The truth has power. When victims find their voices, they are able to expose the evil that's been done to them. And this puts David on his heels. He is not ready for this. He does not know what to do. He thought he was in control, but now circumstances have gotten out of hand. He makes a desperate attempt to regain control of this situation. Listen to verses 6 through 11. So David sent word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." which would have been a euphemism for lie with your wife. And Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, and did not go down to his house. When they told David, Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, "Have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing." I think Uriah knew what was going on. This wasn't a culture that kept secrets very well. There have been a whole lot of messengers going back and forth. The people in the court knew what had happened between David and Bathsheba. Uriah's hanging out with the servants. I think he figured it out, or someone told him. And I think that's why he doesn't go down to lay with his wife. I think he's saying to David, "I'm not going to fix your mistake. I'm not going to cover up the consequences of your actions. You did something that you're responsible for." Uriah disobeyed a direct command of the king of Israel, but then he explains it in this way that David has no ability to get angry at him for. In fact, his explanation only serves to highlight David's own faithlessness and failure to exercise his power. Uriah won't go and lie with his wife while the soldiers are out in the field, but David will send other people and lie with someone else's wife. Once again, the victim discovers a surprising power. Uriah refuses to participate in the cover-up. He won't help David by fixing his mistake, and his actions have the same effect as that of his wife. He exposes the truth of David's evil. But he discovers that exposing evil can be dangerous. He uses his power, but he pays for it with his life. Now, because we live in a world of power, we live in a world of victims. Many of us have borne injustice at the hands of people who have used their power in ways that have hurt us, sometimes in small ways, sometimes in large ways. What can the powerless do in the face of abusive power? They can speak the truth. Victims can find their voices. What truth can you speak? Maybe you've experienced injustice. If you're a victim of abuse or assault, the first step is to be able to give voice to what has happened. It doesn't necessarily mean coming forward to the authorities or police if it was criminal. It just means telling someone, starting with being able to acknowledge what has happened to you. Talk to a friend, talk to a pastor, talk to a counselor, talk to someone. Find your voice. If you're not a victim, maybe you need to be the voice for someone else. Maybe you need to speak the truth of something that's happened that someone else doesn't have the context or audience to make known. How can you help prevent or respond to injustice? As Kevin mentioned, we're going to have this event in a couple weeks where we'll be thinking about that as a church. How do we become a community that is safe for victims? How do we recognize it? How do we respond to it? How do we find and proclaim the truth of the vulnerable who've become victims? No one in this world is as powerful as they seem. Even the seemingly powerless have the ability to speak truth. What truth can you speak? Well, the story begins with David abusing his power, but then he discovers in two separate occasions that he can't actually control everything. He has faced the limitation of his power, and this drives him crazy. Listen to verses 14 to 17. "In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter he wrote, 'Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting, and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die.' And as Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant men. And the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite also died. We hardly recognize the man in this story. He's willing to cross any line to cover up his sin. This is the same David who wouldn't kill Saul when he was given the opportunity, knowing that Saul was trying to murder him. And now he sends this man carrying the instructions for his own murder to hide what he's done. What do we do with David, the man after God's own heart, who is apparently capable of rape and murder? We'll come back to that question next week. Our story today leaves that uncomfortable question hanging. How do we handle this? In fact, from David's perspective, it seems like everything works out in the end. Here's verses 26 and 27. When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she lamented over her husband. And when the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. Once again, David is back in power. He sends, he brings, she becomes, and she bears him a son. In the middle of the story, it looked like things might have been spiraling out of control. It looked like David's grip on the situation was loosened, but now he's acted, he's murdered, and everything works out for him. It looks like David has succeeded in coercing a woman into a sexual encounter and then murdering her husband to cover it up. Could this be so? Is this all there is? It sounds like we should join the disillusioned people at the end of the Old Testament in Malachi 3:15 who say, "Now we call the arrogant blessed. Evildoers not only prosper, but they put God to the test and they escape." And this is how the Old Testament ends. Is this the world we live in, where injustice reigns and power can be abused and nothing can be done to stop it? Well, it's not actually how our story ends. There's one more sentence. The end of verse 27. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. All throughout the story, God had been silent, disturbingly so. Where is God when evil wins? Where is God when injustice runs rampant? Where is God when those who have power abuse it and get away with it? Well, he may seem to be absent, but God sees. God always sees. Whether you are the abuser or the abused, you need to know that God sees. To those of you who have some kind of power, and remember, I told you that's all of you, this is a warning. There are repercussions for our actions. We can't hurt people and cover it up. David found that he couldn't really control Bathsheba, he couldn't really control Uriah, and he certainly can't control God. You might be able to control a lot of things in your life. A remarkable number of things in your life are under your control. But not everything. Be warned. Use your influence well. To those of you who are victims, this story can, strangely enough, be a comfort. Yes, David's power allowed him to violate Bathsheba and kill her husband. But they were not completely powerless. Both of them found their voice to expose David's evil. Each of them paid for it, Uriah with his life. But I think that Bathsheba is the most heroic woman in David's story. Every other woman only has a brief appearance: Michal, Abigail, Ahinoam of Jezreel. These women appear and they have significant parts to play, but then their stories end abruptly. Not Bathsheba. She was treated worse than anyone else, but she plays a major role in the continuance of David's line. She gives birth to Solomon. At the end of David's reign, she's instrumental in ensuring that Solomon sits on the throne and not someone else. She's referenced in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew 1, verse 6. And she is likely the inspiration behind the wife of noble character in Proverbs 31. How's that for irony? Bathsheba's story didn't end when she became the victim of sexual assault. She was not undone by the power of another. Bathsheba is the sexual abuse victim whose story doesn't end with that scene. In whatever way you've been a victim, you need to know that you're not alone. It's not your fault. God sees it all. Your story isn't finished. There's more to be written. There's more that God has in store for you. Be comforted. God may seem silent, but he is not absent. God sees. Well, if you remember that powerful position that I held as a 9-year-old, the president of the third grade, most of what I learned is that power has its limitations. I can't remember any of my specific ideas that I was so excited about, but I do remember that not a single one of them happened. And I left that year disillusioned and disappointed. And I vowed, a vow that I have kept to this day, never again to run for any kind of office. Well, it's easy to leave this story the same way. Disappointed, disillusioned. For many people, all they know of power is abuse. Even David, the best king of Israel, the king over the glory days, is dangerous, lustful, angry, deceptive, and violent. When people hear about an all-powerful God, they can't help but assume that he's just like all the rest. No one with power can really be trusted. This is the atheism of our day. People disbelieve not primarily because they don't believe that God exists, but because they don't believe that God could be good. And when people look at the church, often that seals the deal. Now, there are shining, vibrant examples of the church throughout history using her power for the sake of the vulnerable in the world. But the picture that most people have of the church is of grasping for political power, defending herself from real and perceived persecution, and ignoring those people that are suffering most powerfully right next door. David can't be trusted. The church can't be trusted. Why trust God? Jesus. Jesus. If you want an example of power used well, don't look at David. Look at the Son of David. From the first choice to trade his power for vulnerability, he is the example of power used well that we long for. He doesn't grasp after power. He doesn't defend himself. He doesn't trample anyone. He heals the sick. He restores the outcast. And he sees everyone as a person. And then he is abused. He is humiliated. He is killed. Jesus suffers willingly for the sake of others. The all-powerful God becomes a victim for the sake of the vulnerable. If you know people who are skeptical of an all-powerful God, show them Jesus. If you are a victim of someone else's power, look at Jesus. If you find yourself with power, follow Jesus. David abused his power to satisfy his desire and take a wife. Jesus was abused to show his bride that all he desired was her. Whether the evil you face is pressing against you from the outside, or whether it's buried in your heart, come to Jesus. Let him forgive. Let him heal. Let him lead. Amen.